at the town and is now in the possession of the army.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed the exact same spot the whole time. They're outside, I can say that.
Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Come on, Lisa, are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular pit. UFOs over New York,
and I ain't too surprised. Well, the thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I'd gone.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me there'd be days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange day indeed. Most peculiar, mama. Roll!
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello and welcome to edition 441 of Strange Days Indeed. This week, the 4th in May 2007, our editorial contributor Dave Furlott, British UFO researcher author Dr. David Clark, and a reprise of an interview that was broadcast on the radio version of SDI back in August 2003 with Anne Druffel about her book on James McDonald, Firestorm. And every week we ask you for feedback, and sure enough, it trickles in. This one from Bubba, Errol, great show. SDI 440. Somehow Paul Kimball didn't seem half as narcissistic as usual. He sounded serious about the UFO subject, something I'd never heard from him before, and he actually seemed interested in what others in his film had to say. Again, something I'd never heard before in one of his extended interviews. He was darn close to charming. That's one damn fine interview of Paul Kimball in my book. The only part of it is that it seemed out of place when he said he'd wished he'd been born in Jennifer Alba's body. I'd have thought someone as knowledgeable about film and the classics and possessing that particular lifestyle choice would have preferred being Fay Wray. But what the hell do I know? In all seriousness, and after listening to Alfred's commentary, I'd have to admit Kimball was pretty darn close to being reasonable on the program. I'm eating crow. I agree with Alfred. Kimball seemed bright, sincere, and I liked what he said about the thinking behind his documentary. He sounded as though he had no motive other than laying out the truth and trying to eke out a living in what must be an impossibly tough business. That gets my respect, and unless he commits some future digital atrocity, I'm a new Kimball doc watcher, and I don't even care if the guy wants to grow up to be Jessica Alba. There are worse things in life than becoming a cross-dressing UFO documentarian. You could end up contributing to the Republican Party, or worse, becoming a schoolteacher. Terrific interview, great show. I agree with both your guests. The program is super as a podcast, better than ever. Best, Bubba. And thank you, Bubba, for your email. And how about you? SDI at virtuallystrange.net.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
Some of the discussions and posts that have been going on in the UFO updates list has me scratching my head. I can't figure it out, and it befuddles me whenever I try, because there are some people involved in ufology that have such a strong belief system, they would make some theologians envious. Now, I'm not saying that having a belief system is a bad thing. I personally believe in a number of things purely on faith, and every single religion on the planet has evolved from a series of beliefs that cannot be proven or disproven. But what makes me scratch my head is when somebody shows that they believe in something so strongly, they either do not examine evidence showing opposite point of view, or they just say that the real evidence supporting their claim has been tampered with or removed or otherwise embroiled in some conspiracy. Now, when it comes to UFOs, a certain amount of belief has to come into play because ufologists have not yet gotten their hands on an alien ashtray or some other artifact that can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that UFOs are intelligently piloted craft from some other world. In the television series The X-Files, there was a poster in Agent Fox Mulder's office showing one of Billy Mier's photographs with the caption, "The truth is out there," underneath. And that's true. The truth is out there. But we have to keep searching for it when it comes to ufology. I believe that we are not alone in the universe, and that there are other planets out there that are inhabited by intelligent, technological creatures that may or may not look similar to us. I also believe that some of those civilizations could be vastly superior to us in technology and capable of doing things that our scientists claim cannot be done. But beyond those things that I believe, there are things I would like to be true. For example, I really would have loved it if the alien autopsy film had proven to be the real thing, or it was true that if I used a high-powered flashlight, I'd be able to signal UFOs and have them land in my backyard. But these things are not true, and they have been shown to be, what's the correct diplomatic term? Oh, yeah, falsehoods. I would even love to learn that Men in Black and Men in Black 2 were documentary films produced by a movie studio from another planet. But guess what? They're not. They're very entertaining pieces of fiction. I think part of my problem with all of this is that recently I found myself enjoying watching various episodes of CSI. And although that also is a fictional television show, it's based on something that happens in real life with real-life crime scene investigation units. The one thing that is constant and true about both CSI the television series and CSI the real thing is that they both have to dispassionately follow the trail of evidence regardless of where it leads them. I guess what it boils down to is that I like to think that all ufologists are like those people that I respect in ufology. Stanton Friedman, Kevin Randall, Dick Hall, David Rudiak, Gildas Bourdais, just to name a few. Although they have done a lot of research into various UFO cases, they have come to some conclusions that they are not capable of proving, beyond a shadow of a doubt, what they believe. However, they have also done everything in their power to try and find some other evidence that proves they are wrong. And you will gladly look at whatever somebody brings forward. You see, I may believe in something, but if somebody comes forward and shows me that what I believe is wrong, I may get a little angry about it. I may even throw a hissy fit about it. But when it all boils down to it, I will accept the proof. I'll tuck my tail between my legs and go home. I will not beat my chest and yell loudly that I am right, and ask the people not to try and confuse me with the facts. Sometimes, being able to recognize the facts is what makes the difference between somebody involved in ufology being recognized as a ufologist or as a saucer head. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Nice analogy, Dave Furlong.
Thank you.
With CSI.
Yeah, the show is very good, but the reality is, like, CSI investigations don't get ended at that hour, but they do take their time to get through stuff. They have to look at the evidence, and only the evidence. They can't turn around and assume, okay, this guy is guilty, and now let's try and prove him guilty. And in some situations, that's what we're having with in the field of ufology. Somebody is going, this is the way that is, and I don't accept anything else. And it's like, no. You've got all this evidence over here, pal. Look at this. This proves that that could not possibly have happened.
Obsessive behavior, some might term it.
in a lot of ways, it is very obsessive. The people just are refusing. It's like Stanton says, don't confuse me with the facts. We've got a lot of facts out there. When we find the facts, we have to accept it, whether we like them or not. That's the truth of the matter.
And we've talked about this so many times on the program now,
mm-hmm.
about obsessive-compulsive behavior. And I'm certainly no psychoanalyst, I'm not a psychiatrist, and neither am I a physicist. But when you look at the evidence, even from your point of view or my point of view, or, you know, the seriously interested, you have to say, okay, enough is enough. We can't keep going back over and over. Here's the evidence. This is what we've concluded from the existing evidence. There's no further evidence available. Let's move on.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the main trick, too. It's, okay, this particular case, whatever it be, we've come to this conclusion so far. That doesn't mean that we're not open to looking at new evidence, but that is the key. New evidence.
New evidence, yes. Oh, please let there be new evidence on several of the cases that have been discussed on the UFO updates over the years.
Oh, I really would love to see some of it. The thing that bugs me is I'm sure there is some new evidence out there that hasn't been discovered yet, or, to be quite frank, is being hidden.
As always, Dave Frelott, a great take, and I'm always grateful for you when you point out the fallibilities of others and not mine.
Also my own fallibilities, yes. I might add.
Hey, we'll talk to you next week, Dave Frelott.
For sure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The last couple of times that Stuart Miller has been on, he has mentioned Dr. David Clark in several contexts, and I figured that it would be a good idea, since we've talked about Dr. David Clark on the program in the past, to bring David Clark to your ears. So joining us on the phone from his home in Sheffield, England, is Dr. David Clark. He's written many books, including Out of the Shadows, UFOs, The Establishment, and the official cover-up with Andy Roberts, The UFOs That Never Were with Jenny Randles and Andy Roberts, and Phantoms of the Sky, UFOs, A Modern Myth, again with Andy Roberts. So joining us on the phone from his home in Sheffield, England, is Dr. David Clark. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you.
It's about time, after 8 years and your many years on the UFO updates list and other lists and forums, and now with your own website, drdavidclark.co.uk.
I was reflecting upon this only recently about how long I'd actually been involved in the subject, and it's quite worrying, really. Most of my adult life. I mean, the time that I can sort of think back to when I first became interested in UFOs, I must have been a teenager, sort of certainly 14 or 15 years old, when I went to see the Close Encounters of the Third Kind when it was on general release over here in England, which I think must have been the spring or summer of 1978. And I remember being very, very spaced out by seeing the film, and after that point, I was more and more curious about UFOs, and I wanted to know, you know, what lay behind the premise of the film. And I distinctly remember later that year, in December, family used to sit around and watch the late news before we went to bed, and I remember the newscaster, the top item on the news at 10, which was most unusual for English TV, and it was a UFO story, and it was the famous film of the UFOs taken by the Argosy airline over New Zealand on New Year's Eve 1978. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, I saw that film, it was fantastic, and this seems to suggest that, you know, the film was fiction, but obviously something is going on, and we are being visited by something. So from that point onwards, I think I can trace the growth of my interest in the subject. And I distinctly remember afterwards in the new year going to the city and basically trying to buy just about every paperback book I could find that had the letters UFO on there. So that was the genesis of my interest, and I've never been able to escape right up to the present.
Mm. Are you like me? Do you still play with your mashed potatoes and make Devil's Tour?
Yes, I do sometimes, I must admit, much to the annoyance of my partner.
That movie, that film, had a similar impact on me, too. You have investigated or looked into many cases in the time that you've been involved with UFOs. Your favorite?
My favorite case? Recently, I've been asked by 14 Times, where I write a monthly column, Flying Sorcery with Andy Roberts, to contribute to their 60th anniversary issue, which I believe is out in July. And one of the things we were asked to produce was a list of our top 10 favourite cases. And I know Paul Kimball has done a similar thing for his recent TV documentary. And this case I picked out as the one that I think is probably the most impressive and certainly unexplained is the close encounter at Livingston in Scotland in November 1979, which is the one where the forestry worker, Mr. Robert Taylor, who recently died, unfortunately, he was out in the forest, he turned into a clearing and saw this huge dome-shaped semi-transparent object sitting there in the woods. He was then approached by two smaller objects, which looked something like wartime mines, which seemed to drop from the larger object. These approached him, both on each side of him. He lost consciousness, and the next thing he knew, I think he woke up about 20 minutes later. His dog was barking. He had this horrible taste in his mouth. Dragged himself home. Police were called. He was examined by a doctor. They found traces at the site, and it's never explained, and it's still sitting there on the Lothian police case file as an unexplained incident all these years later. And he's never changed his story. There's been various attempts to find a rational explanation, some of them more fantastic than the idea that he saw an alien spacecraft, I've got to say. And that is the one case that I remember from that period when I first became interested in UFOs that I believe has never been adequately explained. So I would pick that out as a favorite. There are many other similar incidents that I find inexplicable, and that's the reason why I'm still involved, even though I'm very skeptical.
I've noticed your skepticism over the years. I want to stick with the Scottish case for a moment. All of the documentation on that case by the Lothian police presumably has been archived somewhere, yes?
That's a very interesting point, because quite recently now we've got the Freedom of Information Act in the UK. You can now make requests to the police and to the Ministry of Defence, various other places, which you weren't able to do in the past. And I recently made an FOI to Lothian for their case file on this, and they told me that everything had been destroyed, that they'd not retained any of the documents from their investigation at the time. And that is quite typical of the authorities here. We often only preserve statements and evidence where it's not directly related to a serious criminal incident. It's often destroyed after a set period of time, usually a couple of years, sometimes 5 years. Luckily, in this case, it's one of the few cases that was thoroughly and properly investigated by a UFO association at the time it happened. And in this case, it was Bufora. I'm not sure what their status is at the moment, but certainly at that time, in the 70s and 80s, they had a very, very good system of investigators, a network that covered the entire country. And in this case, Stuart Campbell, very much a UFO skeptic, he did actually do a very, very good, thorough and objective investigation of this incident, and his case report was published by Bufora. And in the case report, fortunately, he managed to obtain copies of the Livingston CID documents relating to this particular case, including a signed statement by Robert Taylor given to the police, a forensic report, all kinds of things, and they were all collated in this report. Now, it's not available on the internet, unfortunately, or direct paper copy. There's very few copies of this report in circulation, and I feel it's one of the best that was done at the time. But again, this is a problem that needs to be addressed by ufology, that there is lots of material such as this that isn't widely available. And if it's not on the internet, it doesn't tend to exist in a lot of people's minds, which is unfortunate.
What you're saying is that the only copy of the stuff that was found during the course of the investigation is lodged with BUFORA, the British UFO Research Association?
Yeah, it's an appendix in Stuart Campbell's report that he prepared for the BUFORA, which was published by them in 1980 or 1981. It's just it's no longer in print, which is unfortunate.
And I wonder who has copies of the original publication?
Very few ufologists. Mm-hmm. I only recently obtained a copy of it from another ufologist who preserved it. I just find it's unfortunate that so much attention is given to what I deem to be very poor UFO cases, and good ones such as this are very little known and very little discussed. I think that's partly as a result of the fact that this subject has got such a large back catalogue that lots of material is overlooked, and lots of material that was published in the past, which is not available online, tends to be overlooked, which is unfortunate.
Are you likely to put up your copy of that case on your new website?
I'm not sure who the copyright belongs to. I do understand, though, that BUFORA have got an ongoing program of scanning their publications and past case files for release onto their website. I'm not sure what their current status is, because quite recently they said that they were cancelling their public lectures, that they were no longer having a magazine, and that they were going to be entirely internet-based, which seems to be the way that much of ufology is conducted in the present day. So I'm hoping that at some stage Stuart's report will turn up on their website.
BUFORA has been inactive of late. There doesn't seem to be much going on at their website. There are very few researchers who were involved with BUFORA, the British UFO Research Association, who put BUFORA after their names anymore.
I served for some time as a BUFORA council member, and if I go back to what I originally said about my involvement, I think I must have been one of the youngest investigators for BUFORA. I mean, I remember writing to Jenny Randalls, must have been 1980 to 1981, to say, please, could I be an investigator? And I must have been no more than 15 or 16 years old at the time. At that time, BUFORA and Contact UK, which was the other big organisation in the UK, were ufology, but ufology was practiced in a very different way back in the 70s and the 80s. Again, I keep coming back to the internet, and I think it's the internet that has changed the way things are done. I don't think people are all that bothered anymore about joining a very large organisation and subscribing to a magazine. I think they much prefer to sit at home and surf the internet. They can get all the information that they feel they need via that method, and I think there's a lot of cynicism that people don't want to belong to an organisation. I don't know whether that's reflected in North America, is it? Do you have the same problems?
Very much so, yes. The Mutual UFO Network of Ontario here did basically what BUFORA was doing in order to increase membership and to increase the number of people who would become seriously involved with the organisation and actually go out and do the investigation, do the research.
Mm.
And they would hold monthly meetings, and 40, 50 people show up. But they weren't interested in becoming involved with the organization. They wanted to be entertained for their $5 admission.
That's a key point. That really is. And I think a lot of people, certainly with the investigators and the people who are involved in serious research, I think the money that is paid for subscriptions, and certainly with BUFORA, I mean, there's an R in the acronym BUFORA, which relates to research. And I think there was a lot of cynicism that monies that were being paid to join a research organisation, what was actually being spent on research and investigation? Most of the funds seem to be going into entertaining people in the way that you've just said, putting on a public lectures, putting out a publication. And that's okay when there's a lot of public interest in the subject of UFOs, when the subject's high in the media, when there are films, etc., etc. But as soon as interest drops away, as it has done since the 50th anniversary, and there's less media interest, there's less sightings of any note, and I think that's when the big organisations tend to start having problems, and that has obviously impacted on BUFORA in a big way.
As has the internet. People are very happy to download their email from whatever list they're subscribed to, and with their tea or coffee go through that, and that's the extent of their serious interest.
It's a double-edged sword in that the internet is pretty useful in that nowadays, when there's a big sighting like the one over O'Hare Airport comes along, you get instantly all the information that's available is available to everybody across the world. I mean, in the past, you would have to wait months to receive information. People would be using typewriters and knocking together newsletters, and it would take a long, long time for information to filter around. And on the internet, it's there immediately. But the other side, it does tend to dumb down ufology, I think, in some respects, in that you just get endless arguments rather than actually saying, right, let's do something and let's go out and interview someone. It's very easy to sit at a keyboard and argue with somebody via email, but if you are really serious about getting to the bottom of mysteries, the best thing to do is to pick the phone up and do some real investigations, and that is what I've tried to do. I've tried to cut through all the tiresome arguments between skeptics and believers that just go on and on and on, and actually say to myself, right, if something needs resolving, the best way to do it is to go out and do a proper investigation. And being a journalist, which is the profession I went into, that to me is quite a natural thing to do. I'm used to picking up the phone and tracking people down. I'm used to bothering the authorities and being persistent and not going away when they tell me to go away. And I suppose that's why I've ended up looking at the aspects of ufology that I have.
You have a PhD, yes?
I do, yes.
So your PhD is in what?
It's in folklore and cultural tradition. I studied at Sheffield University part-time. It took me around 10 years to complete. The relevance of that is that Sheffield University is the only university in England, not in the UK, there are similar bodies in Wales and Scotland, where you can actually study folklore to PhD or MPhil level. The whole centre is unique. It's got an archive of material that stretches back to the mid-1960s, a very large library, and a very thriving teaching schedule, and lots and lots of postgraduate students who are conducting research into folklore-related areas. So I've got this dual background in that I studied archaeology originally for my degree and followed that up by doing a PhD in folklore, but at the same time, to earn a crust, I was working as a journalist, so put me in a unique position to look at contentious claims such as the ones that I've been interested in. And you'll see, if you look at my website, that UFOs is just one area of the supernatural or the paranormal, whatever you want to call it, that yeah. I've been interested in. I've written books on the more traditional supernatural themes, such as ghosts and legends, and I've also written a book quite recently on the First World War legend of the Angel of Mons, which has got many crossovers with UFOs, not in direct terms, but in the way that people believed that the British Army had been saved by angels, a vision in the sky that was seen over the battlefield. And I investigated that in great detail, both historically and by tracking down people who had some memory of that, and tried my best to get to the bottom of the mystery. And at the end of the day, a large question mark still remained.
Well, it's much like Fatima or Fatima in Portugal.
Exactly, yeah.
The evidence is in the eye of the beholder, so British troops saw angels, and the three children at Fatima in Portugal saw the Virgin Mary.
Mm. Mm. The problem with the Fatima case is that we do know who the witnesses were, and there's little doubt that they did have some kind of mysterious or supernatural experience. What I found with the Angel of Mons story was that it had been portrayed by the media at the time and in lots of subsequent books that there were numerous witnesses, i.e. soldiers, who had testified to having seen angels at the time. But when I actually investigated this in great depth, which involved lots and lots of research in newspapers, tracing written statements, etc., etc., I was unable to find a single named witness who'd actually reported seeing something that could be described as an angel at the time. So to me, it turned out to be more of a story, an urban legend, rather than a real event. I did actually find someone in the end. He died by the time I reached him, but there was a recording that he'd made at the age of 101, who was in one of the Ulster regiments, who'd actually been interviewed by a BBC reporter in the 1980s, and he described seeing a figure of a man holding a flaming sword emerge from a cloud during the midst of a battle. But because I was unable to speak to him directly, and the story was a bit ambiguous to say the least, that was the nearest I came in the case of the Angel of Mons to actually finding a first-hand witness. But you do have to bear in mind that I was looking into this many, many years after the events, and that many of the people who were there at the time had died, but the strange thing is none of them had left an unambiguous statement about what they'd seen.
I wonder if those witnesses had actually officially reported, and if there was an official report about it all at some point, whether they had the time to do it, you know, with what was going on, the Battle of Mons and subsequent battles. And you have to wonder if perhaps there was an official report that disappeared.
Well, there was allegedly one of the senior officers, a brigadier general in the intelligence corps, had actually recorded something about the visions that were supposedly seen in his contemporary diary. All his papers and his diaries were archived in London. And although he published a book in the 1930s saying that he'd made this entry in his diary at the time about these angels, when I actually tracked down the original diary itself, the entries that he claimed he'd made were not there. And to me, putting together all the evidence, it suggested that he had rewritten the diary entries. He admits this in the book he wrote in 1931, and he'd added his memory, subsequent memory, from what he'd read in newspapers and what he'd heard from people, in the rewritten entries from his original notes. So, again, that seemed to rule out what he'd actually said at the time as being something that was definitively contemporary. So this is the problems you face when you're trying to reconstruct, you know, what actually happened.
I guess in a way it's similar to Roswell, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and you really do have to be very, very careful in how you interpret people's memories as opposed to actual definitive contemporary records from the time. We do know from the time of Roswell, obviously, that something did happen, but the dispute is over what precisely that was.
And ongoing, too.
Mm. I don't know if there's any doubt that the alien autopsy event is a hoax. I think with Roswell, I'd just prefer to suspend judgment, although my natural inclination is to believe that something did happen, certainly, but I bet it was something connected with some top-secret experiment that went wrong.
Well, as Nick Redfern said in his book, testing balloons and flying wings using poor sods from captured Japanese units.
Yes, that's the case. I mean, I distinctly remember back in the late 1980s, John Keel coming over to give us a talk here in Sheffield for our independent UFO network. And the talk he gave was on the Japanese Fugo balloons. I think he was trying to imply that one of these balloons had perhaps crashed at Roswell. And although we know that's not the case, there is this connection with balloons, that the one that Nick Redfern has recently resurrected. I'm not entirely convinced by that explanation, but it seems to me from the descriptions at the time, and that is what you've got to go on, the contemporary descriptions of what was found does seem to fit with some kind of balloon. You can argue and argue and argue, but you cannot get away from that. And unless somebody comes forward with some more definitive evidence, and I'm sorry, but people's testimony given 20, 30, 40 years later isn't evidence. It's evidence of something, but it's not contemporary evidence, does not convince.
I'm actually puzzled by the United States Air Force's final word on the Roswell case that came out coincidentally with the 50th anniversary 10 years ago, stating that what people saw were the parachute test dummies. There must be paperwork or a paper trail that goes back to that time, which they could have surely pulled out and said, look, here's the paperwork, here's the balloon flights, here's what was recovered, and on the days that were recovered from the various flights. But they haven't done that.
I can see the point. I mean, I'm not convinced at all that these crash test dummies had anything to do with the Roswell incident, but I can also sympathize with the position that the United States Air Force find themselves in that whatever they produce, I mean, and you can draw parallels here with the British Ministry of Defence as well. There is this suspicion that they aren't being straight with people, that they're hiding something. And it just seems to me that whatever they produce, whatever documents they turn out, it's not going to be enough, because unless it provides the evidence to the people who believe that Roswell was an ET crash, then it's not going to be accepted. People are always going to be finding contradictions and picking holes. It just seems to me that we assume that the government, because it's the government, must know the answers to everything. And it's very, very disappointing to some people, seemingly, that when it turns out they don't, that they haven't got any evidence, that there is nothing, that whatever it once existed no longer exists. People find that difficult to believe. I find it quite straightforward. If they don't honestly know the answer, they're being pressed to give an answer, all they can do is the same that we do if we're doing research. We go to the sources that exist. And if the sources don't provide the answer, then there's not really much more that can be said. As far as I can see, it's an honest opinion based upon what evidence survives, which is not much.
You mentioned the Ministry of Defense in the UK, and Dr. David Clark has been a huge thorn in the side of the Ministry of Defense with his Freedom of Information requests. N'est-ce pas?
Yeah, oh, certainly, yeah. The background to that lies in two different areas. Firstly, as a journalist, I teach student journalists. That's part of what I do at Sheffield Hallam University. And the course I teach is journalistic research techniques, which includes how to use the Data Protection Act, how to use the Freedom of Information Act, etc., etc. So obviously I wanted to practice this myself rather than just teaching the subject. And it seemed quite obvious for me quite early on, even before we had a Freedom of Information Act here in the UK, that one way to test all these stories about that there's a government cover-up in this country, in Britain I'm talking about here, would be to use this new legislation and to find out what really is known, get to the bottom of some of the claims that have been made about the Ministry of Defence and its involvement in the subject. So right from the late 1990s, I had a double-pronged programme, both of going to the National Archives in London, where lots of material had already been released under the 30-year rule. And also, there was a precursor to the Freedom of Information Act called the Code of Practice for Access to Government Information. And I started just putting in tentative requests under that, and that was an arrangement whereby historians or interested people could apply for access to government documents, and they would look at them, and if they thought there wasn't anything contentious, that they would release them. And the first thing I turned my attention to was the Rendlesham Forest incident, which is continuing controversy almost on par with Roswell on this side of the Atlantic. And there was always this suggestion that the British government or the MOD knew a lot more about the incident than what they were saying, and that they said that they only had one document, which was Colonel Holt's memo. Now, we knew that they'd done some kind of assessment in order to reach the conclusion that this case was of, quote, no defence significance, which is the mantra they always use.
Yeah.
So it just seemed to me a bit odd that we had this legislation, which has been in place, I think it was in 1994, and yet no one had used it. No one had written to the MOD and said, please will you send me your file on the Rendlesham Forest incident using the Code of Practice to Government Information. So in 2001, I did just that, and I was really surprised that they got back and said, yes, we've got this file, it's got something like 150 to 200 enclosures, we've been through it, it's all unclassified, would you like a copy of it? So I said, yes, please send me a copy, and within a week, this thing dropped through my letterbox.
Mm.
So I just thought, well, from that point onwards, I've been mounting this campaign to find out exactly what they've got on this subject and get access to it, and as you will see from the results, I quickly followed up doing detective work at the National Archives to get to the bottom of where their interest first began. I found the minutes to this Directorate of Intelligence committee that was held on the subject of flying saucers in 1950, and quickly that led me to the Flying Saucer Working Party document, which ufologists over here had heard a hint of from the request by Winston Churchill for information on UFOs in 1952. But no one had actually found the original document, and it took a long while to actually extract this from the MOD, because firstly they said that they were aware of it, but they hadn't been able to find a surviving copy. I would not give up, and I found a reference to the actual name of this thing and when it had been produced, and eventually they found it in another file, and this was quite important. It wasn't in a file about UFOs. It was in a file about scientific intelligence. So this is where often this idea that there is a cover-up or that the government is not being straight with people who ask for things. It's the way that bureaucracy runs, is that sometimes things are filed in different places so that when someone goes to look for that particular material or that document 10, 20, 30 years afterwards and they can't find it, the answer that, no, we don't know anything, is honest, because they might not have looked in the right place. In this particular case, someone had filed the last surviving copy of the Flying Saucer Working Party in a file, the title of which was unrelated to the subject. So it was only by being persistent that I eventually got them to produce this thing. And from that point onwards, I've just requested file after file after file. And from 2005, in January, the Freedom of Information Act came into force. And this has become quite a campaign. And I don't want to take the entire credit. It's not fair to take the entire credit for this campaign, because there's a whole group of similarly minded research ufologists over here, including Joe McGonagall, Gary Anthony, various other people who have helped in this campaign, and they've pursued their own particular interests. And as a result, we've been able to bring to light huge amounts of material that has never seen the light of day. I mean, the most important of which has been this three-volume study that the Defence Intelligence staff did, Project Condyne. Lots of people don't know how that word is pronounced, but it's my understanding it's Condyne, as opposed to Condigan or some other bizarre.
That's the American pronunciation, I think, Condigan.
Yeah, I mean, the name itself is quite interesting because people have drawn comparisons to condom, Project Sign, or that it's some kind of pun on those two words. The MOD assure me that they have a computer that just churns out random words for the titles of projects.
Oh, sure.
So maybe that is just a coincidence, but Condyne in the Oxford English Dictionary, the definition of it is something that is a severe punishment well deserved. And ironic or not, I think that certainly reflects the Ministry of Defence's view of UFOs, because the impression I get, certainly what I think lay behind the production of the Condyne report, was basically the fact that the intelligence people over here regard UFOs and ufologists as a pain in the neck. It's something they don't want to have to deal with. It's a historical responsibility that they've inherited that they don't feel should be part of their responsibilities. My personal belief is that this study was done as part of a deliberate decision to remove the intelligence services from any involvement in UFOs or ufology. That doesn't mean that they haven't got a historical archive, and as you probably aware, my most recent, or our most recent campaign, now that we've identified which files have been produced by the Defence Intelligence staff on UFOs, we identified 24 separate files from the mid-1970s to 2002 that they've preserved. Until recently, they've been contaminated with asbestos, so they've been out of bounds for anyone to look at these files. They were part of a group of 63,000 files in all that have been affected by this problem.
Wow.
But as a result of the pressure that's been put on them by historians, because originally they were going to destroy the lot, all 63,000 files, all dating from the Cold War, full of lots and lots of information, not just UFOs, but, you know, the RAF's involvement in the Falklands War, Cold War nuclear secrets, that sort of thing. All the lot was going to be destroyed, but as a result of the outcry, they've been forced to scan the entire original collection of files onto CD-ROMs, and those are now being considered for release, both at the National Archives and via specific FOIA requests. So the campaign that myself, Gary, Joe and Andy have been involved in over the last 12 months is basically, now we've identified these 24 Defence Intelligence files on UFOs, to preserve them and to get them released. And as a result of the pressure that we've piled on the government over here, we've got MPs involved, we've tried every which way under the Freedom of Information legislation to persuade them to save these files, to scan them, to get them onto their website. And I think partly as a result of the pressure we've applied, and also it's got to be taken into account that the French released their archive on the French Space Agency website earlier this year. I think the momentum of all that has finally led them to relent. And I'm really, really pleased that sometime later this year, I gather within the next 2 months, the first batch of these files will be uploaded onto the Ministry's website. So the good thing about this is we can argue about what this evidence means or doesn't mean, and there are lots of people with conflicting viewpoints, but I just find it very pleasing that everyone will get the chance to see these files when they finally go onto this website. So we can all look at them, we can all draw our own conclusions, and there'll be none of this arguing about who got there first, etc., etc. I've got to say also that there was a small group of files from the late 70s produced by the Defence Intelligence staff that did not get contaminated. It escaped this problem. And they were released at the National Archives last year. And there were some very, very interesting cases in there involving air crew. One in particular, a fantastic observation by the crew of a Vulcan bomber over the North Atlantic, who saw a very bizarre object seemingly pacing their aircraft, and it was recorded on radar. The radar film was analysed by the intelligence staff, and it's there in the files, and various ufologists have already seen this material, and I just hope that there will be some similar incidents of that type in the files that are due to be released. In fact, I'm sure there are.
Do you see any evidence of gun camera footage or footage shot by aircraft of UFOs?
Now, that's a very interesting point, yeah, because I don't know whether you remember Ralph Noyes. He was quite a senior civil servant in the Ministry of Defence who came out in the late 1990s to say that he believed that something was going on during his time at the MOD in the 1950s through to the 1970s that couldn't be explained. And he said one of the things he remembered was being shown some footage at a private screening at Whitehall of gun camera footage that had been taken by RAF pilots, presumably sometime in the 1950s. And he thought it was related to the famous Lakenheath incident in 1956, but I'm not sure that that is correct. Mm. And no one has been able to get to the bottom of this. I know that Nick Redfern made some inquiries. I know that Nick Pope, when he was in post at the MOD in the mid-1990s, did look into this. In fact, I've got the papers which shows that he did look into it, but he didn't really look very far. He only asked the Air Historical Branch if they'd got any information about any UFO films that have been preserved, and they checked with the Imperial War Museum, the usual sources, who said, no, we've got nothing, we must presume it's, if there is such a film, it's been destroyed. So that remains an unanswered question, and one of the problems we've got with this intelligence material from the UK is that much of the interesting material from the 1950s was destroyed. It was definitely destroyed, and I've seen the destruction certificates for some of these files. So it may well be that a lot of the most interesting material, certainly relating to the Lakenheath incident, and maybe some of these gun camera films, has been destroyed at some point. Why is another matter. I think it's scandalous.
I was going to ask, why would they destroy film footage like that? It's not as if it takes up a great deal of space.
Yeah, difficult question. I mean, if you speak to people who deal with this type of footage, it's not the sort of thing that does preserve. It rapidly deteriorates, and also it's not footage in the way that we understand it, in that it has to be very carefully reconstructed and interpreted before you can make sense of it. So I don't think it's a simple factor of it could have been preserved. I think it may well have deteriorated. It's quite possible. But even so, you would expect there to be some kind of written evidence, that some kind of analysis that was done by the intelligence people of that footage, even if the footage itself had not survived. And what I can say, and this is a bit of an exclusive for you, is that I have actually found some evidence for at least one of these gun camera films now from the 1950s. That is recorded in one of the RAF operation record books, and that relates to an incident in, I think it was 1955, where two Hawker Hunter jets were involved in practice interceptions over the North Sea, and one of them was using a gun camera to take footage of the other aircraft as part of the exercise, and nothing was seen at the time, but when they returned to the airbase and re-ran the film, what looked like a bright globe of light was seen pacing one of these the aircraft that was being pursued. And the information I have is that this footage was deemed to be interesting and was sent through to the intelligence people for analysis. What happened to it after that point, I don't know. But that evidence does seem to suggest to me that what Ralph Noyes said, and we can't ask him now because he died in 1998, unfortunately, what he said he saw back in the 1960s when he went to this screening of this gun camera film, this incident from the 50s, of which there is evidence, does seem to back up what he said. I'm sure that there was gun camera footage. But what you've got to ask yourself is, what did it show? Even Ralph Noyes said that the footage that he saw at the time didn't show solid structured craft. All it showed were bright pulsating lights, dark objects, nothing that you could say specifically was a structured object. So what we're talking about here is, as the Condyne report described, unexplained aerial phenomena, possibly some kind of plasma or some kind of unknown natural phenomena or meteorological phenomena. So it's entirely possible, as a result of that, that the footage itself or the analysis of the footage was never filed under the subject of UFOs or flying saucers, as they were known in the 50s. It's possible it's gone somewhere else for analysis, and that the label on the footage or that the descriptor of its content was something like meteorological phenomena or atmospheric phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why somehow it's got lost in the filing system. And anyone who's worked in the government, certainly over here, will be able to testify just how bureaucratic our government is, compartmentalized in the way it works, in that, you know, people working in one department who might be in the next room to another department have no need to know, and people don't share information unless it's absolutely necessary. So it's quite understandable, when you look at it in that context, as to how something could be destroyed or disappear.
Another needle in the haystack.
Exactly, yeah.
The footage was sent, you said, to an intelligence branch for analysis. Would that be the same intelligence branch that is trying to divest itself of responsibility?
It's not the same branch, but it's certainly the predecessor of that branch. I mean, the branch you will recognize is DI-55. They are the intelligence branch, part of the DSTI, or Defense Intelligence Staff, who've been responsible for UFOs since 1967. But prior to 1967, the MOD, the form that we see it today, dates only from 1964. Before that, rather than there being one MOD, we had the three different services, the Air Ministry, the Royal Navy, and the War Office, which is the Army. And they each had their own intelligence branches. And it was the Air Ministry's intelligence branch who would have dealt with UFOs, or in fact, who did deal with UFOs. So when the modern MOD was created in 1964, and those three different parts of the armed services and their intelligence branches were merged together, the UFO responsibility that the Air Ministry had under the branch known as DDI Tech was moved into the new, larger MOD structure. And it's at that point that DI-55 invested with that responsibility. And as well as that, they will have inherited the relevant files that the old Air Ministry DDI Tech branch would have kept on UFOs. And it's at that point in the early 1960s, and I can definitively identify the exact year that most of these old files on UFOs were destroyed. It was in 1961, and I've seen the destruction certificates for some of these files. And I believe it was at that stage that the file on the famous Lake and Eve Bentwaters incident, which I'm sure all your listeners will recognize, was destroyed, unfortunately. So what the ministry made of that particular case, which is in my top 10 of inexplicable incidents, even though there are some reasons for thinking it was explained or could have been explained, we will never know, because the Air Ministry MOD, in their wisdom, someone who perhaps was unsympathetic towards the subject, and certainly in the early 1960s, we were going through another ufological dark age. They didn't believe that the subject was of any public interest. They'd not had many questions about it at that particular time. And someone said, let's destroy these files. We just don't have the space for them. Most of the things that have been reported, we've found mundane explanations for. The few that we haven't been able to explain, we don't believe anyone will ever be able to explain. What's the point in keeping the paperwork? So someone, way back then, decided that this stuff was no longer worth keeping. So when we look at these files, these DI-55 files that are shortly to be released, they all date from the late 1970s. And if you read the Condyne report, the person who wrote that report had access to the DI's entire archive, and even he was unable to find very much information about their historical involvement in the subject. It's a real mystery, even to people with high security clearance. And the reason is that an embarrassing decision was taken in the 1960s to destroy their historical records on the subject, and that has stymied our entire knowledge of that early period and much of the subjects, such as the gun camera film that we were discussing earlier, has been lost as a result. Transpose that to the controversy over the Roswell incident. A lot of the problem seems to be that a lot of the messages that went in and out of the Roswell Army Air Force Base at the relevant time have been destroyed. And the people who believe that they are significant are going to interpret that as meaning that they're trying to hide something. Why did they destroy these messages? But if you just look at the way that governments run and the way that bureaucracy operates, things are destroyed, like it or not. You have to live with that fact.
Especially in the days of hard copy that took up a lot of space.
Exactly.
And nobody's exactly. ever going to want to read this again, so we may as well just toss it.
Exactly. Their attitude, if questioned, will be, this is the MOD's attitude. I've asked them, where is your file on the Lake and Eve incident from 1956? We know it happened. We know it caused a major air defense alert. Surely you must have preserved some papers about it. And their attitude is, well, someone back in the distant past must have looked at this material. There was a mundane explanation for what went on, and it was deemed at the time that there was no reason to preserve the papers. Therefore, they were destroyed. How can you argue with that?
Mm-hmm. For the sake of our listeners who don't know about the Lake and Heath case, can you give us a potted, in a nutshell, kind of description of it?
Certainly, I think it's worth some attention, because I think it was the only British case that is featured in the Condon study from 1969. Basically, in 1956, it was a series of unexplained, unusual observations that were made on United States Air Force radar at the Lake and Heath base, which is in East Anglia, in eastern England, with a complex relationship that the USAF had with the Royal Air Force at the time, in that they had a number of bases on British territory as part of the defence against the Eastern Bloc. And yet, the Royal Air Force, obviously, because this was UK territory, if something was detected by the Americans, it was up to the British to respond and to investigate, even though the USAF had aircraft of its own. We don't know for sure that the Americans perhaps didn't take some part in what transpired, but suffice to say, things were seen on radar, both at RAF Bentwaters and later the same night at RAF Lake and Heath. Objects, phenomena, we don't know they were objects, that were moving at fantastic speeds, that were seemingly approaching the UK from the North Sea. And if you see that in the context of the time, we were at the height of the Suez Crisis, imminent Third World War. This could have been the real thing in terms of, you know, a Russian attack. What we found subsequently through a very detailed reinvestigation, myself, Martin Schuff, Jenny Randalls, various other seasoned investigators over here have looked into the case as best we can, in the absence of any official documents, or very few official documents, it seems that over an eight-hour period that particular night, whole numbers of RAF aircraft were scrambled from the quick reaction alert bases to go and investigate these mysterious blips that were performing acrobatics on the airfield radars. And the account, as it's come down to ufology, is mainly from the Condon study. This was based upon some telegrams that were sent from Lake and Heath to Washington at the time, and the testimony of one of the air traffic personnel, Forrest Perkins, who had actually been there. He was in charge of the air traffic control centre at Lake and Heath when all this was going on. The classic description of what happened was that two RAF Venoms were scrambled to intercept one of these blips that were on Lake and Heath radar, that they tried to intercept it. They couldn't do so, and the pilot was overheard talking to another pilot that this thing had sort of zipped behind his aircraft and was now behind him, and he was running short of fuel, etc., etc. This is the classic description that has come down into the UFO literature. But at that point, we didn't know who these pilots were. No one had tracked them down. There'd been no official Minister of Defence statement on the Lake and Heath incident. And I've been quite amazed when I've looked at the material held at the National Archives, which stretches right from the mid-1960s through to present, right through from 1969 to the mid-1980s, when people became aware that this incident had happened, because don't forget it was on the secret list before 1969, people started writing to the Ministry of Defence and saying, what can you tell us about this fantastic incident that's in the Condon report that was published in the USA? About this incident in 56 when RAF Venoms were scrambled. And the internal correspondence that you could see if you go to the National Archives in London is these people at the Ministry of Defence who were in the same position that Nick Pope was in the mid-1990s, they were saying, people are asking us about this case, what do we know about it? And they went and asked the Air Historical Branch, they asked the Defence Intelligence staff, what do we know about this incident that we keep getting these letters about that's in this Condon report? And the answer comes right, we don't know anything, because the papers on the case have all been destroyed. Someone destroyed them in the early 1960s. So they were never able to give a definitive account of what went on. And what's happened subsequently is that through very, very detailed investigative work, we've tracked down a number of the people who took part in this on the British side, including Freddie Wimbledon, who appears to have been the fighter controller at the Central RAF base, Neeti said, in Norfolk, he believes was the person who scrambled the Venoms involved. But what we found is there wasn't just the two Venoms that were reported in the Condon report. There was at least two or three waves of interceptors that were scrambled at various points during the night. And I believe I've identified the pilot of one of the two aircraft that were involved in the classic central incident that's in the Condon report. Unfortunately, he died in 1988. But the bizarre thing about this was that in the 1970s, this guy, who was seemingly one of the Benham pilots, actually became the person on the UFO desk at the Ministry of Defence who was answering questions on this very subject. And in the files is a letter from a ufologist, a member of Bufora, asking this man, Anthony Davis, what he knew about the Lakenheath incident. And in his briefing, he says, well, I was there. I was flying a Venom at the time. I was directed to this, what I was told was a UFO. I was unable to pick it up on my radar, and I ended up chasing a star. And that is the totality of his comment.
Oh, my.
It doesn't seem to support the classic incident, but we haven't found all the pilots who may have been involved. We've found some of them. And both myself and Jenny Randalls have interviewed the pilot and navigators of two other Venoms who were scrambled seemingly later that night to respond to an object that was on Lakenheath radar that the Americans were monitoring that they couldn't explain. The material is all on the net on Martin's website dedicated to the Lakenheath incident, but one of the crews, John Brady, and I can't remember the name of the pilot, but John Brady was a navigator. I had a very detailed interview with him, and he remembers this incident distinctly. And his logbook, he showed me his logbook, it's there very clearly, and if you go on my website, you can actually see a scan of the relevant entry. He actually picked this thing up on his airborne radar. He instructed his pilot to intercept, and they made at least three passes on this blip that was seen from the ground that they could see on their airborne radar, and they could not intercept it. Every time they tried to do so, they were unable to perform the usual interception that you would expect if this thing was an actual airborne object, as they were used to intercepting. They were used to going out over the North Sea to intercept Russian intruders high over the North Sea. This was 4,000 feet above the English countryside, and as John Brady told me, you know, really, if this was a hostile, i.e. Russian aircraft, it would be too late once it was over the to do anything. So he said, yes, I did have something on my radar. This thing was seen on the ground radar, but we couldn't intercept it. And the word he described to use it was ephemeral. It wasn't a solid object. It was some kind of either an atmospheric phenomenon or even a weather balloon. That was one of the guesses he made. I don't know how a weather balloon could hang around for that length of time.
And avoid being intercepted.
Yeah, but it does seem to suggest that maybe, despite all the ridicule that has greeted the publication of this Condon report, that maybe they were onto something, that there is some kind of mysterious, unknown natural phenomena that sometimes shows up on radar, sometimes doesn't, that appears solid when seen, sometimes doesn't appear solid, etc., etc. Something like a rainbow that you can only see at certain times from certain directions, that appears to be real when you see it, but isn't really solid. It's a theory that's worth considering, I think. There are all kinds of mysterious natural phenomena. You only have to look at William Corliss's books to recognise this. There are all kinds of bizarre, mysterious things that are going on in our atmosphere, in the upper atmosphere, lower atmosphere, that we can't fully explain. And there's no doubt in my mind that some of those can explain some of the more inexplicable UFO incidents. Ball lightning, for instance, even though we don't really know what ball lightning is and it's just as contentious as anything else, there certainly seems to be something that people have described as ball lightning that may explain inexplicable UFO incidents. Certainly, ball lightning has been suggested as a possible explanation for the Livingston case, the Scottish Forester incident. Mm-hmm. Quite how ball lightning could explain that, I'm not sure, but it's one of the options.
And how is it that something like ball lightning would show up on radar when you need a hard surface, a metallic surface, to reflect a signal back to the radar?
That's a very good question. I mean, I'm a journalist, not a physicist, so I do not understand how radar works. I've only got a very basic understanding of this. I do understand that this was one of the problems that was tackled in the Condon report. There's a very large section of volume 3 of that report that goes into this very problem. And that the problem was is that the person who wrote that report was saying, look, we've got all these thousands and thousands of quite interesting and detailed descriptions of these UAPs, as they call them, which I believe they're pronounced WAP UAPs. But we don't have a corresponding number of radar detections of these things. So what they appear to have been interested in investigating is why these things, if they are some kind of atmospheric phenomena, why defense radars are unable to detect them. Or it seems that on some occasions they have detected them, but on others they haven't. Or that the radar detections that they do have don't correspond with the visual sightings, and this is a real problem that you can trace back into the UFO literature. You know, a lot of these classic radar visual reports, that you cannot, there is no definitive correlation between some of the radar incidents and the actual visual sightings, which again does seem to suggest that we aren't dealing with solid objects in the definition of structured craft. We're dealing with some kind of plasma or natural phenomena. I mean, again, I am not an expert on that area, and I don't pretend to be, but as a layman, it seems to make sense to me.
When I sit and talk to people about this, and I have all of this stuff running through my brain, little pieces of the jigsaw that I'm desperately, while I'm listening to you, clip it all together. And as you said a little while ago, it's ephemeral. It's like quicksilver. It slips away.
Exactly, and that's a real problem. But it's nonetheless fascinating. And I'm generally regarded as a skeptic. Some people see me as a debunker. And to me, I don't see that as something to be ashamed of. If there is bunk in a subject, then it needs to be debunked. Because once you've debunked all the garbage, you can get to the actual heart of the mystery. And I hold my hands up and I say that although I've been able to successfully debunk lots of so-called UFO incidents, there are a large number that I have been unable to explain. And as a result, my curiosity is maintained, and that's why I'm still heavily involved in the subject. And I do believe there is a mystery, an unexplained phenomena, or phenomena, lots of different phenomena, that lies at the heart of the phenomenon. And it only relates to a tiny percentage of cases, but those cases tend to be the strongest ones.
I mentioned at the outset, David, that Stuart Miller and I had talked about you on the last two appearances that Stuart made on SDI. And the reason that your name came up was that Stuart had said he had been talking to you, and you had reminded him of a book by Bernard Newman called The Flying Saucer.
That's right.
And Bernard Newman was apparently a prolific author in the 30s and 40s, I guess.
That's right, yeah. He used many different pseudonyms, apparently, including one, Don Betteridge was one of his favourites. Now, this particular book is mentioned in the most recent book that I've just published with Andy Roberts, Flying Saucers, A Social History of Ufology. It's a book on ufologists in the British Isles and how the subject originated here and how differently the subject evolved from the early days up until the late 1970s when the book ends its coverage. It's not about UFOs per se, but one of the people covered in the book is Bernard Newman. Because we look at 1947 and we look at how the British newspapers covered the news that was coming from the other side of the Atlantic, the Kenneth Arnold sighting, the Roswell incident, which was covered quite extensively in the London Times, the Scotsman. And what we discovered, and this is not something we found exclusively, because Bernard Newman's book, which was written and published during 1947, early 1948, it's been known about in ufology for quite a while. Nick Redfern has written about it. I believe it's been mentioned in quite a few publications. Bernard Newman was a prolific author, as you say, but if you look into his background, he was also an intelligence officer, and I've been able to discover that he was certainly working for MI5 during the Second World War, and there's evidence he was working for the Secret Intelligence Service before that, certainly during the First World War. So he had lots of intelligence contacts, and he seemingly had an interest in flying saucers. Because his book, The Flying Saucer, published in 1948, although it's a work of fiction, is based upon the events of June and July 1947. And his opening chapter is explicit in setting the scene. It's a fictional depiction of a group of scientists who are worried about the opening of the Cold War and who are trying to dream up a way of bringing the two sides of the Cold War together. The way they decide to do this is by faking the crash or a number of crashes of extraterrestrial spacecraft. And that the way that these incidents are portrayed in the book, it draws a lot upon H.G. Wells' description of the cylinders from Mars in The War of the Worlds. The first one of these flying saucers crashes in England, but bizarrely enough, and this is where the Roswell connection comes in, the second crash takes place in New Mexico. And the flying saucer is immediately surrounded by the US Army, and bits of it are examined by experts, one of which is from the British Museum, and the metal is described as hard, unbreakable, and there are strange markings on it similar to Egyptian hieroglyphics. And this is all threaded into the fictional account of these crashes around the world. There's another one then in Russia. There's a fourth one in which is found the remains of an extraterrestrial creature which has been pieced together from lots of different Earth animals by this group of scientists. And the whole inspiration for this is that the world is in a terrible state, that there's an imminent Third World War, and that they, by basically faking these crashes, these scientists in this fictional plot could get all the sides together, the Russians, the Americans, the British, and get them to work together. And Bernard Newman's inspiration for this book, which he says in his autobiography published in the 60s, came from a speech that was made in March 1947, i.e. before the Kenneth Arnold sighting, in which Anthony Eden, who was then Foreign Secretary, who later became Prime Minister after Winston Churchill, he said the world was in a terrible state and that the only way that nations would work together is if that there was a threat from Mars. And that was where he got his inspiration from. And I think certainly he saw and read and was fascinated by some of the early sighting reports of flying saucers, Kenneth Arnold and Roswell, which he'd certainly seen and read and was fascinated by. And I think he stitched the whole theme of this book together from Eden's speech and from the inspiration that he was given by flying saucers, by the sightings in America. Now, what you've got to ask yourself was, given his intelligence background, did he know anything else as a result of his connections with MI5, MI6, and the British government?
Exactly.
And you, in the context of what we now know about the Roswell incident and what may or may not have happened, it does make you ask questions and it does throw open a number of different possibilities. What do you think, Errol?
Well, I was going to ask you how his plot line, how his story, after you get past the first chapter, how it coincides with the timeline since 1947, 1948 until now, and UFO history.
Well, his plot, again, it's fiction, but there's a happy end to the story in that the peoples of the world are united. And if you want to sort of expand that into the history of ufology, you can draw parallels with the comments that were allegedly made by Ronald Reagan. I believe that both Reagan said something about, you know, that maybe America and Russia would eventually work together if we were threatened by hostile extraterrestrial race. And I believe that Gorbachev subsequently said something very similar. That was quite recently. So you can see that whether this was a fictional story or not, it certainly seems to have far-reaching consequences and maybe reflects some high-level musings by someone in government or intelligence circles at the time.
It certainly happened here with Prime Minister Lester Pearson, who also made reference to alien invasion.
Yeah.
Or the inference was that it might be alien invasion that would bring everybody together. It's a speech he gave when he accepted his Nobel Peace Prize.
It's intriguing, isn't it?
Isn't it, though?
I'm not quite sure how the Roswell incident fits into this particular scenario, if indeed it does. But, you mean, it is virtually certain that Bernard Newman must have begun writing his book very shortly after the events of June and July 1947, because, again, I go back to the fact that it was published sometime in the spring of 1948. Mm-hmm. Now, although he churned out hundreds and hundreds of books, he must have been a very busy man and a very efficient writer. He must have been writing his book sometime between the summer and autumn of 1947.
Yeah.
Now, unless you can correct me, as far as I'm aware, there is no other book that was published at that time on this subject. Even though this was a fictional book, it was still a book based upon flying saucers. As far as I'm aware, the earliest books published were in 1950.
Not that I'm aware of. I've not heard or even come across any other book that was written about flying saucers around that time.
Mm. Which adds to the interest. And as I say, the book has been mentioned in passing by various ufologists over the years, but I don't think anyone has quite appreciated how important it is.
Yeah, it was so obviously he cribbed the title from the newspaper reports in the United States.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And interestingly enough, the copy of the book that I've got is one of his copies, which he had personally inscribed to his friend, Basil Little Hart, who was a very, very famous British soldier and military strategist. And he'd inscribed, and I've got the book here in my hand, and inscribed in his own handwriting is, "I hope you will find this amusing," to Basil Little Hart.
Yes.
Now, make what you will of that comment. What did he mean?
Well, perhaps that Little Hart knew something that had been incorporated into the book.
Yes, that's my conclusion.
Otherwise, why would that one book be given to Little Hart rather than copies of his other books?
Exactly. And the thing is, although Bernard Newman, as far as I'm aware, there's very little of his personal correspondence that survived, Basil Little Hart's archive has been preserved. There's a huge amount of his papers that have been preserved at the Central Military Archive in London, and I've been through his papers with a fine-tooth comb. And interestingly enough, Basil Little Hart was also equally fascinated by flying saucers, because there is a very large file in his papers of newspaper cuttings about UFOs and flying saucers that begin right at the very beginning in 1947. And he continued to collect newspaper cuttings and articles and this, that and the other on the subject right until his death in 1969. Mm. Now, the two men knew each other, and as we know, Bernard Newman sent Basil Little Hart, who was a close friend, moved in the same intelligence circles, a copy of his book on flying saucers, inscribed as we've described. Now, what was going on there? What did they know?
I guess we'll never know. Or maybe we will one day when we pass and look back on all of this.
Maybe. I certainly think it's going to be a long, long time before we can get to the bottom of some of these things, if at all.
Oh, I really want it to be in my lifetime, David.
So do I.
Yes. I think we have come to the end of our time together this time. I've been having a really good time, and I would really like to do it again at some point.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to do it again, yeah. And thank you for inviting me on in the first place.
It's a pleasure to have you on, David, and look forward to the next time.
I'd love to come back again and have another chat, and maybe I can update you on the most recent developments when we finally get these files released.
Yes.
Which is sometime in the coming year, hopefully.
I will head directly for you once that happens.
Thank you.
If not before. Dr. David Clark, that's Clark with an E, .co.uk is David's website. Again, Dr. David Clark with an E, .co.uk is the website. And in case you missed it, having repeated it twice, it's in the program listing for this program, 441. David, we'll talk to you again. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Bye for now.
Ruffle is our guest this hour. She's the author of Firestorm, Dr. James E. McDonald's Fight for UFO Science. And it certainly was a fight. Ann Ruffle began investigating UFO reports in the Southern California area in 1957 with the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, directed by the UFO research pioneer Major Donald E. Kehoe. She got to know Dr. McDonald through his work with NICAP from 1966 to 1971. After NICAP's demise in 1970, she joined the Mutual UFO Network and currently sits on the board of MUFON LA, Los Angeles. Ann Ruffle has researched over 2,000 reports of UFOs and related phenomenon, and published over 180 articles on various aspects of the UFO enigma. Like her other books, The Junga Canyon Contacts with parapsychologist D. Scott Rogo and How to Defend Yourself Against Alien Abductions, her latest, Firestorm, Dr. James E. McDonald's Fight for UFO Science, is destined to become a classic. Ann Ruffle, welcome.
Thank you very much, Errol.
We've touched briefly in the past on the late Dr. James E. McDonald, but for the benefit of listeners who know nothing about him, tell us about your connection with Professor McDonald.
Jim McDonald, we called him Jim. He was a brilliant atmospheric physicist who was widely rated in the scientific field. He was known for his papers and for his work on climatology and meteorology. He had the Office of Naval Research contracts with the U.S. government to do work on such questions as should hurricanes be seeded offshore so they wouldn't be so violent onshore, things like this.
Good idea.
Well, he found out that it wasn't a good idea.
Oh.
That actually, if you seeded a hurricane offshore, that the rain would be even more violent onshore.
Oh, it becomes more intense, in fact.
It becomes more intense, yes. And it was things like this that whatever a scientific puzzle caught his attention, he just went after it like a tiger. And he wouldn't let go until he had found an answer. Sometimes it would be a simple question in physics. Sometimes it would be something like whether hurricanes should be seeded offshore. But when he got an interest in the UFO phenomenon, when he saw an object himself he couldn't understand, then when people in Tucson, where he was based, where he taught at the University of Tucson, started to contact him about things they were seeing in the sky, this was about 1958, he spent 6 years of a very quiet, private time investigating local reports, and finally, he thought that he had to come out public because the UFO question had become to him a serious scientific problem that the scientific community was ignoring. This to him was intolerable, that a scientific problem would be ignored.
It's still intolerable to a lot of people, and the scientific problem still being ignored.
Right.
There were a lot of the early researchers lived in his neighborhood in and around Tucson, huh?
Well, a lot of them did in the APRO, you know, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. But when he was casting around for lay researchers and other scientists who were investigating UFOs, he chose NICAP because he got along very well with Major Kehoe and Dick Hall, who was the assistant director at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw that NICAP had investigative subcommittees all over the country and in other countries. So he chose NICAP to work with because they were very congenial with him, and he was indeed congenial with us.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful person.
What sort of work did he do with NICAP?
He didn't do anything specific with NICAP. He was asked to be on the board of governors of NICAP, but he felt that he shouldn't have anything specific to do with the organization, but that he would share data. As he went around the country with his climatology work, he would investigate cases that were prominent in those areas, and then he would share his very excellent data with NICAP, and they would share their information on that same case with him. And so this is the way he built up 600 absolutely fine UFO cases which could not be explained according to the most careful study that he could have done on them.
600 cases.
600 cases, and he was only in the field for 6 years publicly like that.
That's amazing. That's an average of what, a case every 3 days or something?
Something like that. You see, this man was a tireless person. There aren't many people like this in the world. He would attack problems like a tiger, I said. He would fight to get his opinion over when skeptics and debunkers would make ridiculing remarks, or if these so-called contactees, who were very prevalent in those days, would come to his office and want to talk to him, you know, about having been to Venus the night before, he would practically throw them out the door after being cordial for 15 minutes. Show him the door.
Well, it was good that he tolerated fools for 15 minutes. I mean, a lot of people don't even go that long.
Well, I think he would tolerate them until he was sure about what they were. And then when he realized that they were saying something that couldn't be proven,
mm-hmm.
and that fell into the realm of what we call contactees in those days, he would show them the door.
Mm. He looked into 600 cases. Presumably he wrote up every one of those cases.
Oh, he did.
What happened to all of those reports?
Oh, the organization of his files was amazing. When he died, he had left behind a letter saying to his wife, please find a place for his UFO files, because it would be horrible if they were just simply burned. And he suggested at that time maybe even the library of the University of Tucson would take these files, but he didn't think so. But then around 1991 and 92, I had a chance to get a grant from the Fund for UFO Research to archive Jim McDonald's files. And I set about it with his widow, Betsy McDonald's, help, and they are now a public access in the Personal Collections Division of the University of Arizona at Tucson.
Oh, that's wonderful.
They're in wonderful shape.
So Betsy McDonald hung on to them all of those years.
Yes. They were in three or four cabinets, and they had a little room on the back of their house, and they were just carefully guarded there by his family. Even though practically none of his six children and his wife had any interest in UFOs at all, they guarded these because they were his and they had meant so much to him.
Well, thank God that they did. What kind of problems did Jim McDonald have as far as the scientific community were concerned?
He had great problems, you see. His academic colleagues at his university in the Institute of Atmospheric Physics, where he also worked, which is on the campus of the U of A there, they didn't think that this was a suitable subject for a scientist to be studying. And they told him these were his friends. So he would explain to them how important it was in his mind. And because these academic colleagues respected him and respected his work highly, they just let him go do what he wanted, because in those days he did have academic freedom, something that is not very common now. He was such a wonderful speaker and had such a brilliant mind and could organize facts so well that he spoke before hundreds of these very influential scientific organizations. And he would go from city to city doing this, as well as his regular work with climatology and meteorology. He just added UFOs to his life, you see. The thing he did was to stick to one basic fact in his talks to these scientists, that there was this scientific problem involving unidentified aeroforms, he called them, meaning craft, that were close enough to see that they were some kind of craft, yeah, other than just a blob of light. They were traversing Earth's skies at will, were being caught on radar and other sophisticated technology. They were being chased by jet pilots and seen by very reliable witnesses, groups of reliable witnesses on the ground, and by the pilots themselves. And this is the one basic fact he stuck to. And he didn't go into the problem or the idea of a possible occupant, possible motives, nothing like that. He felt that if he could get the scientific community to accept the basic scientific problem of the unidentified aeroforms whizzing around, that then they might be able to go later on into what he called the peripheral questions of occupants and motive. This is what researchers nowadays do not do. They spread themselves over the whole blackboard, so to speak.
Yeah. All of the various aspects of the phenomena.
Yes.
That surround UFOs.
But this is how he addressed the scientific community, and the reason they gave him so much attention for those 5 or 6 years that he was doing this. And when they would ask him, what is your hypothesis? He would be very, very cautious. He would date 8 possible hypotheses that were in the field, and then he would say the hypothesis he must favor at this time was that possibly they were from an extraterrestrial source. But he said that this is least unlikely hypothesis, meaning to him the most likely, stated very scientifically, the least unlikely hypothesis. And scientists liked this, too, the fact that he would not come out and say, well, I'm sure these things are from outer space.
In the course of his talks, did he pick up a lot of support?
Yes, he did. During these 5 or 6 years, he did this. He gave hundreds of talks. The rooms were crowded. There would be hundreds in the audience of scientists, engineers, other technical people, and anybody that could manage to sneak in would go in.
Yeah. What became of those supporters? Did they join NICAP? Did they form an organization around Jim McDonald?
No, I think a very few of them joined NICAP, but of course they didn't have the academic freedom he had. Nobody seemed to, or the fearlessness. The AIAA, I believe it was, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, I believe that is the one that formed a UFO subcommittee. And they had taken McDonald's idea and the idea of other researchers that if a tracking system could be set up that would involve the military, the government, the scientific community, and the public, you see, and the public, to try to track these things in their passage through the skies, that this would be a way of getting undeniable evidence of their existence, especially if you brought radar in.
Yes. Of the 600 cases Jim McDonald looked into, did he have any particular favorites among those?
He was always looking for cases that had evidence of scientific value. In other words, scientific validation that these things existed, you see. And so his favorite cases were called RV cases, which is radar visual. And that is when the object was seen in the air by a pilot and caught on the plane's radar. It was caught on ground-borne radar and also seen by witnesses on the ground. This is what he called the RV cases. This is what he was going after the last 2 years of his life. But then he found a remarkable case called the Laken Heath case, which no one had ever really examined before to any extent. And it took place over eastern England, where there were the RAF and the United States Air Force bases together. They were both in eastern England. In the morning and late evening of August 12th, or 13th and 14th, 1956, these bases were continually alerted to groups of objects coming in from the North Sea. Some of them were flying very high, some of them were flying very low. They were caught on the radar by planes in the air and on the ground-borne radar. They were seen by witnesses both in the air and the ground, you see. And this went on for hours. These groups would come over, and even an RAF jet intercepted one of them.
Oh, really?
Yes. He was following this object, but then the object would flip over to his right wing, and then he didn't know where it had gone, and he'd look over there, and there it would be, and then it would flip over to the back. And his buddy, you know, his buddy in the other jet was seeing the object do this and was utterly amazed. And so both of those, the pilots, well, one of them ran low on gas, and the other one decided that there was nothing he could do with something like that. But they did their best, the RAF jets. And now this particular case was classified for many, many years, both by the U.S. government and the English government. Nobody knew, especially McDonald, didn't believe in a government cover-up. He thought it was a government grand foul-up. That's why we public wasn't learning anything about what the government was finding out. But when he found this Laken Heath case and put it all together, here to him was proof that the UFOs were an international problem and that they were covered up internationally. Also, the Air Defense Command in Colorado Springs here was alerted during this, and they gave the alert to the White House. In other words, something's going on, and you know what's in the Oval Office, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were thinking, well, are these things from Russia? But they couldn't be because they didn't behave.
This Laken Heath is not the case that we know as Rendlesham. This was way before, but still connected to that base.
That's right. It's the same area of England, mm-hmm. and the Laken Heath Air Force Base was part of the later Bentwaters case.
Right.
In fact, there were three military bases connected with the 1956 Laken Heath case, but it's known as Laken Heath.
A lot of us who have some idea of the Jim McDonald story know that, unfortunately, he suicided. On the one hand, you say that he was well accepted by his peers when he went out and talked about unidentified flying objects, but somehow, I guess he got terribly depressed about the non-acceptance of his work in this field?
Well, it wasn't the non-acceptance of his work, because he was being very effective in interesting scientists to study the problem objectively. He was even getting these really good sightings from scientists themselves who had always been afraid to tell anyone about what they had seen. And some of those are in my book, together with the scientists' names. And he was getting sightings from military personnel, and from civilian workers at military bases. And some of these were so confidential that the people later told him, well, I'm afraid I've spoken out of turn. I think it's classified.
Huh?
And so McDonald, for those, would always say, I don't want to hear anything that's going to get you into trouble. He was extremely effective. He had broken through the barrier to the American and the Australian and I think the Canadian media.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of them concentrating on contactees and their wild stories, they were giving airtime and TV time to McDonald and a few other scientists and researchers who were bold enough to speak out. So he was being a very effective. But then what I call in the book an orchestrated attack began against him. And it was things like this. He would travel all over the country, into Australia, up into Canada. His luggage was continually lost. And when it was returned to him, he would notice that it had been rifled through. And then one of his briefcases was stolen off of a plane. And this was after he had gone to China Lake and Edwards Air Force Base, where there was very sensitive information about a particular sighting in California that he was seeking.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he did get it and had written them down in his briefcase, was stolen. He was being followed by cars, these strange surveillance-type cars with no license plates around Tucson, and he couldn't figure this out. He was being impersonated by someone unknown, and this man was going around the country claiming to be James E. McDonald. He had a copy of Jim McDonald's driver's license and his ID from his university. And this impersonator was telling UFO witnesses, don't talk because the government doesn't want you to. Just the opposite of what McDonald would have told them. And then he was being offered funding by various organizations like the National Science Foundation and the National Academy of Science. But then these offers of funding would be drawn back abruptly, and he couldn't understand this. He was being offered consultant jobs with Blue Book, which were abruptly withdrawn, no explanation. Toward the end of his life, he told two very trustworthy people in the field, Dr. Robert M. Wood and Marty Lohr, who was part of the NICAP staff, that he was talking to people at the highest level, that he couldn't unfortunately say anything right now, but he thought that soon he would be able to tell what he had learned about UFOs and what the government knew about UFOs. And then all of a sudden, that was cut off. He didn't speak about that anymore. So apparently he was being led on by some kind of little group high in the government who wouldn't let him talk, which was really dismaying to him because he liked to share data whenever he got it.
Yes.
And then he was publicly ridiculed on his UFO research at a congressional hearing by a congressman called Leon Conti and two of his cohorts. The hearing was about the ozone layer. Remember, they were going to build fleets of supersonic transports that would transport civilian flyers high in the stratosphere. This was in 1971, and McDonald did a lot of work on this. At first he thought it was all right, but then he did a lot of work and a lot of investigation, and he came to the conclusion that if we had fleets of 500 airliners flying in the stratosphere high, you know, 50,000 and higher feet, it would damage the ozone layer so badly that it could not recover. And just one of the results would be a very dramatic increase in the cases of skin cancer over our continent.
Right.
He was ridiculed at this hearing by Representative Conti and two of his cohorts. They didn't ridicule him about his testimony on the ozone layer, but they brought up the fact that he had testified a couple of years earlier at an open congressional hearing on UFOs. They mixed his words up so that they had him saying that there were little green men flying around the sky and things like this, and the audience was actually laughing at the hearing. And McDonald had never been ridiculed. You didn't ridicule a man of that standing.
Mm.
You don't ridicule anyone, but particularly someone like this.
Yes.
But he seemed to recover. he went on with his ozone work, and he proved to the scientific community that he was right, and the other environmentalists too, who had testified at this hearing, that they were right about the ozone. But even this, you see, didn't seem to send him into the depression. But there were certain things that happened in his family, which might too have been part of orchestrated attack.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in the book. They're very involved. They were things that, you know, just don't happen. I hypothesize in the book that perhaps he had been led into the depression by sources unknown, well, you know, government sources,
yeah,
something like that, to bring him into this depression.
And they pushed him over the edge eventually.
Pushed him over the edge, yes.
An amazing man. Wendy Connors, whom I'm sure you're very familiar with, and a regular contributor to this program, has been collecting UFO-related audio for many years, and she very kindly sent me just a very brief clip of James McDonald. I'd like to play that for you, Anne.
Oh, I'd love to hear his voice again.
The UFO problem is the greatest scientific problem of our times. I think there are essentially four kinds of explanations. First, you might have hoaxes and frauds. Secondly, misidentified objects of terrestrial origin. Third, unusual psychological disturbances of some kind. Fourth, some kind of extraterrestrial vehicles engaged, let's say, in surveying our planet. I go for the fourth one, the idea that objects may be surveying our planet.
Thanks to Wendy Connors for that. A very intense man, huh?
Oh, he was a very intense man. But yet, when we would have meetings whenever he was in town on his regular work, and he was so sociable and humorous that you couldn't imagine that a person with such sociable tendencies could be so tireless and so persevering and so intense. Just a magnificent person, and we missed him just absolutely dreadfully when he died.
I guess being the scientist that he was, and then becoming interested in unidentified flying objects, and having been highly respected for his opinions on, for example, the seeding or non-seeding of hurricanes before they got to the American coast, and having been held in high esteem for that work, and then getting into UFOs and being held in esteem by the scientists that he talked to during the course of the 6 years, and then suddenly turning around and finding the nasties and the sneakies that were being done to him, and that could have only come from one direction, and that would be the government. I guess that was devastating to him when that realization set in.
I don't know if he ever realized that it was the government. But I think later, you know, in the last months of his life, he was beginning to realize that there was very possibly a government cover-up instead of just foul-up, bad scientific advice and that.
Not specifically the government, you know, but certain agencies within the government. Government, for all we know, knows absolutely nothing about any of this at all.
Possibly the president, the Congress knows nothing about it at all.
But there are black or dark organizations within the government that are funded by the United States. Their budgets come from the United States government, and the United States government has no idea what's going on with it.
It's called the black budget. Yes.
Black budget. There we go. That's what I was groping around for. I want to thank you for being with us tonight. We could spend several hours talking about Jim McDonald and still not cover all the material that's in your book. I recommend to people. McDonald was a huge influence on a lot of researchers in this field, as many of them will be very eager to attest. It's really a pity that he only spent 6 years working in the field, but he has had influence.
He did put forth a scientific method that even if it's followed today by researchers, we still might be able to break through if we use his very cautious scientific method. And especially try again for the tracking system.
The book is Firestorm, Dr. James E. McDonald's Fight for UFO Science. Anne Druffel, thank you very much. Love to talk to you again on other subjects in the near future.
Wonderful. I'd love to, Errol.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Good night.
As I was standing looking up one day, enjoying the view across the way, some big bright lights came flying by, a lot of whirling doodads in the sky. It's just imagination, but I saw them just the same.
Just imagination, but we saw them just the same.
And
And that wraps up another historically packed SDI. Thanks for the use of your ears. And you can continue feeding your brain between now and the next program by reading the UFO Updates Archive at virtuallystrange.net. And you can give us feedback, too, by emailing SDI at virtuallystrange.net. Till next time.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to SDI at virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.